Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Definitely, I think before this year, I really felt like I was white-knuckling a bit with my career. That I was like, oh, if I can just get that first feature made, then I'll be okay, because then I can do this, then these features will get made. And then it's like, do you know what, man? That's all the middle. Like, don't bother yourself with the middle, because it's none of my business.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to author of books and writer and director of films, Nat Lutsema. Hi, this is Steve Whiteley, comedian, actor, filmmaker and writer, all-round ADHD creative. And welcome to my new podcast, Balancing Acts, where I talk to an array of creatives ranging from comedians, actors, directors, all sorts. And we talk about how they find a sense of balance or not between their creative lives and their everyday lives, and how that has an impact on their mental health and beyond. Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out. Nat is one of those polymaths. She is a BAFTA-nominated writer, a director, former comedian, and author. She's written for the likes of Mock the Week, 8 out of 10 Cats, and as part of her sketch group, Jigsaw, Nat had 2 Radio 4 series and 3 sellout Edinburgh runs. As an author, her adult non-fiction, Cuckoo in the Nest, was a Sunday Express Book of the Year, and Girl Out of Water, which was her debut children's book, was longlisted for the Waterstones Children Book of the Year. Nat currently has a slate of numerous features in development. This was a really, really enjoyable conversation, which took a turn that I wasn't really expecting, and I'm not sure Nat was expecting to talk about it either. We kick things off talking about how she transitioned from first in her student days being a radio presenter to then performing stand-up comedy, sketch, and then to becoming a writer and director of films and author. She explains why she stopped acting and performing stand-up to focus on her writing and directing career, and breaks down how she took on a DIY approach to learning the craft of filmmaking. She explains why she's never Googled herself or her reviews as a stand-up comedian or filmmaker. Nat talks about how before doing gigs during stand-up, she would manifest them going really well, and how she's incorporated manifestation on a regular basis into her filmmaking career. And then this, which we briefly touched upon, is something that we went into great detail poring over in this conversation, and I think it's really interesting and important to hear Nat's experience, because you know, so often you can grind and you can work really hard, but if you don't have, it's either like the right mindset, but also this feeling of something greater than just the need and desire to do well in your career, whether it's like a sense of well-being, just this idea of something greater than yourself. And I feel like that's something that is manifested, like what I did there, in this conversation. So we dive in deep on how she approaches manifestation and what made it click into gear at the beginning of the year, why she decided to adopt this kind of approach and mindset. Now also explains why she does so many different creative endeavors and what it is she enjoys about starting something new. She talks about the importance of not self not being self-depreciating and being kind and empathetic towards yourself. And then on the industry side of things, she explains how she's met her producers and talks about why, obviously, it's so important to have a solid working relationship with your agent. There is loads here, but for me, yeah, the big takeaway from this is how she has adopted this new approach and how and why it's working for her. And remember, if you like this episode, if you like Balancing Acts in general, then please do rate and review it on podcasts. That'd be much appreciated. Oh, and you may have noticed there's new artwork. What do we think of the artwork? Do we like it? I mean, I like it. What do you think? Are you a fan of it? My face is no longer on it, which, you know, some people might argue is a good thing. But I would be very much interested and welcome your opinions if you have any on the subject. And also, how are you enjoying the podcast in general and the conversations? Is there anything that you would like me to focus on? Any feedback would be very much welcome. Okay, so without further ado, over to Nat. Perfect. There's so many different things that you have done in your career, and one of them obviously is directing shorts and features. Is that one of your primary focuses right now?
Yeah, that's the main one. That's really the main one right now. Yeah, I've got a couple of features that I've written that are with directors now that, okay, like, hopefully will get funding and on their feet in the new, in the brave new world. And I've got a horror feature that I've written, co-written, and I'm hoping to direct spring next year.
Fantastic.
And so that's, everything's sort of focused on that, comedies and horrors.
Great. So taking a step back, just rewinding, was your first sort of forays into the entertainment shtick via performing comedy? Because I know you were in your sketch group, Jigsaw. Was that how you kicked things off?
Oh, actually, no, I say that. I was at university and I had a little radio show. And I don't know why I say little. Well, I do. It was in a cupboard. It was a little radio show. And and I won Best Female Presenter at the Student Radio Awards just after I graduated.
Oh, wow, okay.
And then I worked at Glastonbury Festival's radio station for a few years. Yeah. And then I helped the guy there set up a radio station at the Edinburgh Festival, which I hadn't been to before. And so I went there and I was helping him run the radio station. I was presenting shows and I just had comedians in every day and I was talking to them about their shows and I was going to see as much comedy as I wanted for free because I had a press pass, which is, you know, it was only years later when I went back and had to pay that I realized what a massive privilege that was.
Yeah.
But then I completely fell in love with stand-up, which is so funny because I saw loads of stand-ups. I remember seeing Ian Stone gig to like a very small room of people. I'm sure he won't thank me for telling this story now. But then when I saw him back in London, I realized he usually gigs to hundreds of people in big noisy clubs. But I'd really enjoyed him and loads of comics like him gigging to like 20 in a dank little cave. I was
That's like, oh, this is stand-up.
I like it.
Yeah, the intimacy of it in those venues, especially when you're seeing someone that is on the, you know, just on the verge of breaking through. I was there. I saw them early doors.
I wasn't even aware of any of that. So like I come back and some student sketch group, I would have been a bit more savvy than that, but some sketch group I saw perform to six people to me would have been on a par with McIntyre, who I'd have seen perform to, you know, three times as many, but still not many people at all.
Yeah.
And so it gave me quite a wonky view of the stand-up world. But in quite a healthy way, because I was like, oh, that's stand-up. You gig to like 12 people. Okay, cool. I'd love to do that.
So you went from there to transitioning to then becoming a performer?
Yeah. Yeah. And I hadn't performed before at all.
Okay.
So it was kind of learning on my feet.
So did you start doing that open mic circuit?
Yeah. Yeah, I did a stand-up course, actually, the Laughing Horse comedy course.
Okay.
And I don't know, I think people can be sniffy about those courses and be like, oh, you can't teach funny. And it's like, no, dickhead, but you can teach someone etiquette and you can teach someone, like, when someone flashes a light at you from the back of a room, like how to incorporate that and keep on gigging and wrap your set up and things like that, which actually really are important for not annoying, you know, grumpy men called Darren, who are mainly who run comedy clubs. And and like one of the hardest things we did in that stand-up course, and it was only like 6 weeks, once a week on a Monday, was just stand up in front of six other people in a room and tell jokes to them. And obviously they're not really there to laugh because they're thinking of their own set. But, you know, it's, I just don't think you want the first time you ever tell jokes in front of strangers to be actually at a gig where they're expecting entertainment.
Yeah, I have. I fully agree that. I also did a stand-up course. I did the Logan Murray one.
Oh, yeah.
That was really good. Yeah, it was really good. But I found it so hard at the same time for the reasons you've just described. And first gig. The gig, the sort of, I don't know if you had a graduation gig.
Yeah, we did. Camden Head, in Camden, the L-shaped room.
That's where we had ours. That's
really? Oh, yeah. Cool. Yeah. I'm still so fond of that room, even though it literally couldn't be worse for comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got audience can't see the other half.
Yeah, I have fun. And that is like a warm, lovely feeling. Oh, so this is what it's like. And then you go out after that to do your first gig and it's like, okay, I may have underestimated this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had like a really accelerated first year. Like I just think I didn't have a bad gig for about 10 months. Okay. So I just had that I don't know, I think it's called manifesting, you know, when you don't have any negative thoughts in your head. You're just like, I can do this and I have already done it. And it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And like, so I didn't even know what it felt like to bomb. So I'd just get up on stage and smash it night after night. And I'd do about 3 gigs a night because there were just so many gigs around at that time. That was 2007. And I think maybe there was a little bit of a gap in the market for like female comics. There really weren't many when I started, as in there had been more perhaps than they had graduated onto TV. And there was perhaps just a little hole at that moment. But yeah, I just never stopped gigging. And then I think about 10 months in, I started to do really big clubs. And then I was like, oh, this is horrible. No, I don't like this at all.
And that whole period was just you doing stand-up. As a solo stand-up performer.
Oh, I had a day job as well, yeah.
Okay, but in terms of the performing side of things, you weren't yet performing as part of a sketch group?
No, the sketch group, the first sketch group I was in was called Super Clump, and that was 9 of us. Me, Tom Crane, Josh Widdicombe, Henry Packard, Mike Wozniak, Sean Harries, Henry Widdicombe, Ben Partridge, that's the 9.
Wow, it's quite the lineup.
Yeah.
How did that come about, that process of putting a sketch group together and choosing those people?
I don't know. I wasn't one of the originators. I'm fairly sure somebody approached me, and me and Tom Crane were a couple at the time. So perhaps they wanted one of us, but you have to invite both. But I like to think they wanted us both. And yeah, it was the most unworkably large, ridiculous sketch group because there were 9 of us and half were based in Wales and half were based in London.
Wow.
And I'd say about a third of the group needed to nap several times a day. So any writing session usually had a dead body on the sofa somewhere. And then we did, and I can't remember where the decision was to set that group up, but it was perfectly timed because John Briley was doing the £5 Fringe that year at Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And I still think the £5 Fringe was just the most fantastic idea. It was just like a little less swanky than your Pleasance and your Underbelly and all the rest of it venues. But tickets were only £5. And I just think like with free, because I've done free shows, loads of them. And I think your audience often walk in like, oh God, what's this then? And when they've paid 15 quid, they're like, you had better be hilarious in a way that we all understand is universally hilarious. Yeah. And with 5 quid, they're like, okay, well, you're a sandwich and a Coke.
Yeah.
So go on, entertain me as much as a sandwich and a Coke would. And we're like, yeah, bloody can.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. It's so hit and miss on the free fringe. I feel like often it's a case of, oh, it's pissing down with rain outside. We'll just go here to dry off in this show that someone has slaved over. But it's somewhere to keep warm for an hour.
Yeah. You definitely get that feeling. Although there's nothing like being a hot ticket, like getting a good review.
Yeah.
And I've never Googled myself and I've never read my reviews. So
never.
When I did Free Fringe, no.
Was that a decision you made early on?
When I first started stand-up, I'd gone to university with Josie Long and Josie said, never ever Google yourself and never read a review. And I was like, okay. And I didn't even question it. And it just became a habit. And there's definitely been times at Edinburgh where like I knew I'd got a good one because I'd have a huge long queue in the pissing rain outside my free fringe venue.
Yeah.
Equally, there were times I knew I'd had a bad one because people would be like, oh, you're right, mate. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah. It's like, I know what you're referring to, but I don't care. And it can't hurt me if I don't read it.
Yeah. Ignorance is bliss.
ignorance is bliss. And also, like, I know what I think of myself. I know when I've had a good gig and I know when I've had a bad gig. So I don't need anyone external to tell me what I think of myself and my stand-up. Like, I know. I know all my flaws. Don't worry about that.
That's a great attitude to have. Have you carried that over to the other mediums that you've started working in since? Yeah.
I think I've accidentally happened upon a couple of reviews for like short films. And actually, I think maybe there is more of a benefit to be gained in reading a review of your film because it's so collaborative. Mm. Like there are so many, you know, and if the score gets particular praise and attention, I think I want to know that actually, because I know what I think of that score, but I'm not the composer, so I'm not quite as close to it as when I'm the stand-up.
Yeah.
Because with stand-up, like a lot of the time they'll talk about what you look like, the way you stand, the way, you know, these things that you're like, that's just intrinsically me. Yeah. And I can't change that.
So. It feels more of a personal attack at times.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes it is.
Yeah.
Like, fuck off, mate. Get into therapy. Don't take it out on me.
True.
And no, and I don't think I really bother with book reviews. Like people send them to me, but I don't really read them because I think, well, you wouldn't send me a bad one. So I just know that's a good one.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I think sometimes it's just none of my business. I think it was Jen Brister. Stand-up comedian who said that they're not for me. Like those reviews are for people deciding whether or not to come and see me. Mm. And well, I have to be there. So there's no point in me making my mind up.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, it's true.
That is a very healthy attitude. So going back to the performing, what did you prefer? And were you doing both at the same time, stand-up and sketch?
I did prefer sketch because it definitely felt more collaborative and less lonely.
Okay.
And I definitely felt that when I was on stage making male members of the sketch group laugh, I felt it got the audience laughing quicker.
And that was interesting. Wow.
Like younger audiences, I think genuinely didn't seem to mind too much, like what sex was standing on stage, but definitely with like an older, more conservative with a little C audience. Okay. I had a much easier ride with men validating my humor on stage.
Right. That's so interesting. And were you performing stand-up simultaneously while you were also performing in the sketch group? Did you continue doing that?
Yeah. Okay. And actually, it did help my stand-up. It made me listen more because when I was first writing sketch anyway, you know, it's not that you try and give yourself the punchlines, but you are aware who has the punchlines. Mm-hmm. And then you realize when you're on stage that a lot of the time the person saying the punchline doesn't get the laugh. It's the person reacting to it.
Yeah.
Which isn't a thing at all in stand-up, obviously. Yeah. You are the only thing up there.
But yeah.
I remember we had a sketch with Jigsaw called Beeve, where I thought the word bumhole was Irish and therefore pronounced beef. And you go through it bit by bit. And I always liked doing it because I liked saying the funny things. But it got filmed one night and I realized it was Dan Antopolsky getting all the laughs because it was just his face registering the lunacy of what I was saying.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's his sketch. It's not mine.
That's so interesting. So how long did you continue performing for until you got to a point and you just decided to leave that side of things and focus on writing and writing and directing?
Where was I? So 2014, I made my first short film,
okay.
But I acted in that. And then 2015, 2016, 2017, I made a short film every year and I wasn't in any of them, but I did entertain the thought of being in them. Oh, no way. I was in the next one. I also acted in Three Women Wait for Death.
That was the one that was made part of the BFI network.
Yeah. That was it. And that same year I had a tiny role in Florence Foster Jenkins as well, big feature film. And so I suppose that felt like a year with a fair bit of acting in. But then as soon as I started directing, and that was the next short film, Weirdos. Yeah, that was the point where like I just thought I don't know, with my acting, I like with my stand up, I always knew what I did that was different to everyone else. And with my writing, I know what I do that's different to everyone else. And with my acting, like if somebody sees something in me that they're like, I can't get that from anyone else and I want you to do it, then I am more than happy to do it. but I don't see, I don't really see anything in my acting that's, that it just isn't already being done.
Okay, so, that's such a honest appraisal of yourself, which is, I think it's quite rare actually. So you said before that, you know, the stand up, you knew that you were doing something that was different and unique. What did you feel that was, that you were offering that was something different in that respect?
I got pushed out of it a bit by doing bigger clubs and having to go a bit more generic. But at the beginning, right, what I did was very, and it's only with hindsight I can see, I think, that what I was doing that was different was I spoke very gently, and yet I was very commanding, because what I was saying was often very unexpected, frequently quite shocking, but it was all done so very gently that I think you didn't really know what was going to come next or what was going to happen next. And I really regret losing that and being pushed off that position. But that particular voice in stand-up only really works in a room where the audience have agreed to go along with you, where they're like, okay, ooh, where's this going? I don't know. And they're never minded people folding their arms and leaning back, because with a lot of other stand-ups, it would be like, nah, I'm not coming along. And with me, I always felt that they were like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm listening. I'm completely listening. And yeah, I have faith. But then as soon as I was doing bigger, boozier rooms, it just made them feel like they didn't know where they stood. Yeah. And I just think people just don't enjoy feeling that sometimes. It's like why you watch action blockbusters, that sometimes it's much more comfortable to go, oh, God, can see that coming a million miles. It's like, but yeah, you'd often rather watch that though, wouldn't you? And it's done really well, than you'd rather watch something where you're like, my God, where is this going? Oh, that's really unexpected.
Yeah, and I guess there's probably not the same level of patience as there would be in those mainstream clubs. They want the gags.
Yeah, I think ironically, I just took a really long time to say something that really could have been summed up as it requires patience.
So, no, it's really interesting. So you were saying that you arrived upon the decision to stop acting because you felt that you weren't offering something unique. What was the decision?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't in demand either. Okay. Like, I think, you know, if jobs had been being offered, I would have done them.
Yeah.
But I just stopped hunting them up or writing them for myself.
Yeah. Okay. And so, and then was that time the same reason for why you stopped performing in comedy? Because you wanted to primarily, once you worked that out, you wanted to primarily focus on just being a writer director?
Yeah. I mean, so Superclump, we did 1 year together, one Edinburgh year. And that was fantastic. Although we were just about to start making money and somebody, hello, gave everybody swine flu, which obviously seemed a lot more lighthearted pre-pandemic. Then it just made everyone. And I was living with Ginger and Black and Tin and Dueb and Crane as well. And I think I ripped swine flu through them as well. So sorry to everybody. I did apologize at the time.
And none of them performed ever since.
Never. Their voice boxes are no longer up to it because of all the coughing. And then Jigsaw, we did 3 Edinburgh runs together. But it did reach a point where, like, we made so little money that way. And not to be mercenary, but, like, you got to eat. And and then we did our Radio 4 series. We did 2 series of our Radio 4 show together. And then I think Crane probably got more writing work for Josh Widdicombe first. And so he was less and less available. And I think with both sketch groups, more than any other, I think we just sort of quite amicably fell apart.
Okay.
I think it's a bit like my acting career. It took a lot of energy to just keep it going.
Yeah.
So all you have to do is just sort of slacken that energy and it instantly
drifts away,
falls apart.
And was that the same? Would you say that's what happened as well with your stand-up? Or was that more of a conscious decision, I'm just going to stop performing?
Yeah, stand-up I think was a bit more conscious because I am very lucky. I'd been going 7-8 years at that point. So I think there were always people who would get in touch and be like, do you want to do 20 here or there? Or, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd even got on the secret Mirth Control list.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it was hard to let go of the Mirth Control Inner Sanctum gig list. But there you go.
Tough times. So do you look back at the, or I'll rephrase that, do you miss performing stand-up?
I do.
Do you?
Yeah, I really
do. When was the last time you performed?
I went through a bit of a phase of presenting award ceremonies, not big ones, but like ones where you could basically do some jokes and like just be quite like light and funny. And I was actually like, I could see what I brought to that that maybe other people wouldn't bring, is that like I had all of a stand-up's instincts and speed, but I didn't need to like smash a room apart the way like a more match fit stand-up would. I was perfectly happy to just get some laughs sometimes, but basically everyone feel in safe hands. So maybe 5-6 years.
Okay.
2014. By 2015, I wasn't gigging. I got my first like paid screenwriting work in 2015, and I sort of threw everything into that. But actually, funny enough, March this year, I did send out an email to a few people saying I was thinking of doing a bit of stand up again. Does anyone want me? And again, I was very lucky that like just a lot of people who run clubs were like, yeah, come along, come do 10, and then we get you back up to, you know, opening or whatever. And then the pandemic came. So I guess the universe really didn't want
a sign.
My gentle, whimsical, harrowing shit.
You could always get involved in the Zoom gigs, but we've talked about Zoom and that's not an option.
My face. Do you know what it makes me think of? Because presumably your audience all mute themselves, right? So if they're laughing, you just see their mouths open. So there was a run of gigs that was done mainly like the Midlands and up north years ago, which was all done in cinemas because the thinking was that's a perfectly set up venue and all the seats are comfortable and why not use them on the quiet nights? But unfortunately, because the walls are covered in sound absorbing stuff, you are just stood up there in front of a load of people opening their mouths. And it genuinely looks like they're yawning most of the time. And when you get off, like comics would get off the stage in front of the screen looking harrowed and all the other comics would have to go, they were laughing. I promise, I'm standing next to them. They were laughing. And they're like, yeah, were they? Promise.
That sounds nearly as bad as the experience that I would envisage performing in the drive-thrus would be like. Have you seen those?
I haven't seen one in action. I've seen comics taking photos. I've only seen like really experienced comics like Shappy and Mark Watson do it where I'm like, okay, well, you guys know what you're doing inside and out. So you can, and also they actually, the pair of them, I think are really experienced at like Glastonbury gigs and festival gigs.
Okay.
Where I think you have that same feeling of like your audience is half a mile away.
Yeah.
And often they're lying down, which is probably a bit similar to them being in a car. Yeah.
And off their faces.
And off their faces, yeah.
Yeah, which could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how they react.
Yeah, I think with my stand-up, I do need people to hang on with me through a sentence.
Okay. Yeah. So once things go back to normal, do you think you might sort of get back on it?
I don't know. Maybe. I sort of had an idea for an Edinburgh show that I quite liked, which was sort of about me, but not about me, which I think was always what I was looking for. Because by the end of my stand-up, my last Edinburgh show was about a relationship breakup. And actually, it was far too personal. But it didn't feel personal when I was just doing little previews with my mates. And then as soon as you take it to Edinburgh, and I was in like a 200-seater room, then you suddenly go, oh, fuck. Ooh, I feel really vulnerable right now. And I have 3 weeks left to do of this. And I can't rewrite it because it's a narrative and it all kind of hangs together.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what this one is going to be, what, a bit of that, but not all in terms of how personal it's going to be?
I think it's going to be about being a teenager, because I write novels for teenagers.
Okay. Yeah, so, we'll talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, so I sort of about what it was like for me to be a teenager, because I remember it quite vividly because it was an absolutely horrible mess, a lot of it, and talk to some teenage girls who are teenagers now.
Yeah,
and just see how different it is to be a teenager. And well, it's going to be 2020, but I guess 2021, 2022.
Yeah.
And like, look at what they're reading as well. Like, I find like girls' magazines back then were such a hilarious mix of like really worldly, like Position of the Fortnight, as if any of us were having sex. And like, as if any of us were having sex with such confidence that we'd be like, right, Gary, I'm going to sit on your feet and you're going to hang backwards off a bed. Like, no, absolutely not. Whereas now they're reading Teen Vogue, which like I read Teen Vogue because it's so like politically aware and smart. So I find that really interesting.
Meanwhile, us boys, we just had our football sticker albums.
I would have loved some football sticker fun. Yeah.
They
such
were
a
great.
Wholesome thing to do.
They were great. I have fond memories of filling out my first sticker album, completing the game.
I remember Crane doing that, I think, when he was about 28. And on the way back from gigs, I'd bring him a new pack of stickers, wake him up at like 4 a.m. with them.
It's a great gift. That is a good gift.
It is a great gift.
Yeah. Yeah. So on to the writing and directing side of things, what do you enjoy about that, that you didn't get from your comedy career as a performer?
I love being in charge and I love the respect. Never really get any respect in stand-up, but like, but with film, you do get to go, I want everything like this. And people go, yes.
So when you say you don't get any respect in stand-up, do you mean it from an industry perspective in terms of how you're treated?
No, I think it's more in like your day-to-day. I think because it's
okay.
Everybody in the green room does the same job you do, mm-hmm. and some of them do it much better. And that's fair enough. Mm. But I think when you step out on stage in front of drunk people, you're just always the clown, really. Sometimes you might really rip it apart and then someone will come up to you and say, you were great. But I think a lot of the time people are a bit dance monkey dance. Mm. Whereas I do like in film, people are like, yes, these are all your opinions and this is how you want it to be and this is how it will be. And you're like, well, yeah. And I like the collaboration. Like I love working with a production designer. I love working with locations, art design, like costume, makeup. I get really involved in makeup as well. And like, yeah, I love all that. I love like, and also I really love the writing. I think writing screenplays is like the easiest and most natural part of writing to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think because I'm just so aware it's step one in a 3-step process.
Okay.
Whereas with a book, like everything that is going to be that experience, you have to get it all down on paper perfectly as you want it.
Yeah.
And I guess stand-up always had a bit more looseness in it, but I often as well felt that I could write as much stand-up as I wanted. But if I got up on stage and there was just like a belligerent drunk in the front row, chances are I might have to throw everything I'd spent weeks writing out the window and just spend 20 minutes on crowd control. And that would be so sad as you'd then drive 4 hours home.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So when you started to direct, had you done any filmmaking courses or was it very much sort of a DIY approach to learning?
I put myself through film school via YouTube.
Okay, so great.
I just watched and I read every book I could get my hands on, and I BAFTA do a lot of like just talks. You can go and listen to a load of talks at BAFTA if you're like a sort of member of their crew.
Yeah.
And I mean, crew is in CIEW. It's a scheme, not CIU. And so I would go to see editors talk and I would go and see production designers talk. And like, I just learn everything I could about what everybody else's job around me would be.
Yeah.
And that was like the only way I felt like even semi capable on set.
That's great. But, so how long did you go through that process of like learning everything, taking it all in before having the confidence to shoot your first short?
I think I, at the moment I thought I wanted to direct, I immediately applied for this scheme. It was like a competition called Shakespeare's Sister.
Okay.
And it was for a short film by a female director inspired by Shakespeare.
Okay, so great.
I felt like, God, that's niche. And I remember I got first in Shakespeare at university and I was like, come on, you must be able to do this now. So I kind of applied pretty much instantly. I thought about it. Like, I have to say, like, I'm always good on confidence. I think that is thanks to stand-up. I have no imposter syndrome and I have no
really
confidence because, that's, I mean, fantastic. Honestly, what's the worst that's going to happen? Like, if you don't do a good job, like, you are not a pediatric surgeon. Get over yourself. You might make a bad film. Like, I'm sure all filmmakers have one bad film in them at least. So any film you make, it could be that one. And then, you know, your world won't end. You'll still keep breathing.
Have you always had that attitude? Like, so when you first got into stand-up or when you first started acting, were you always that way inclined? As in never sort of thinking it over too much and worrying about whether you're going to be any good?
Yeah. Yeah, I was at the beginning. And then when I had a really difficult 2 years of like dying on my ass a lot. Yeah. And then I think it's the very opposite of that idea of manifestation, because like when I first started, I'd never had a bad gig. So I just always visualized a good gig because that was the only gig I knew. And then once I started dying on my ass, I would get up on stage every night like, oh God, please don't let this be too bad. And of course it would never be that good because I was just going up there with the energy that like at the very least, let me have a quiet death up here.
Yeah.
And so I had to really give myself a shake and get myself back in that confident mindset. because I can feel like my career responds completely according to my confidence and my confidence, really.
Well, you just said the word, you know, manifestation. Is that something that you still do? So talk me through that, how you'll go about doing that with all the different things that you do and how you visualize these things.
So I do that. I've been doing this all year with my my very, very good friend, Yasmin Akram, who she wrote and starred in War Paint, one of my shorts. And I love her. And we read a lot of books about it. And like Neville Goddard, I think, is one of the like oldest manifestation gurus. But it's sort of the idea of like, if you think about what you want, you don't worry about how you're going to get there. You just visualize yourself in your end goal. Mm-hmm. So if I want to get my film funded and I want to get on set, then I'm not going to worry about, well, what if this financier comes on board but that sales agent doesn't want it? It's like, I can't control that. All I can do is visualize myself standing on set, talking to my DP, blocking out with the actors. So I'm just going to focus on that. So I just do that. And it's called living in the end feeling. So I'm like, I'm just in the end feeling where I am making this film now.
Okay.
And yeah, and it's been life-changing. Like, I've never worked as much as I have this year, which I think in a pandemic is kind of miraculous.
Yeah, that's incredible. So that process that you've just described, will you sort of sit down, close your eyes, and just be there for a certain period of time? Do you do that every day? And if so, do you do it first thing in the morning? How do you go about it?
No, I'm not that regulated, actually. I mean, okay. I basically get up in the morning,
yeah,
and I will walk to a coffee shop and get a coffee. To kind mm-hmm. of trick myself that I'm commuting to work, even though I'm going to turn back and walk back to my desk.
Yeah.
But so as I'm walking, I'm thinking about it then. Then if I'm in the shower, that's when I think about it. Like when I'm waiting for my food to cook, I think about it. Like I'm never really one for, I'm going to sit down now and have 10 minutes of like just uninterrupted thinking time.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a lockdown thing. I find we've all got hours and hours in every day.
True.
I suppose if you have kids, you probably don't, but I don't have kids. So like there's just always time. And also what I'm thinking about is things I want to happen. So they're kind of daydreams as well, because they're just very focused, purposeful daydreams.
Okay. That's great. And so you get quite detailed with them. Is that
really
part of the trick?
And I can feel it. Yeah. So Neville Goddard was recruited into the army for World War II, and he really didn't want to be there for obvious reasons. Who the hell would? And he wanted to be honorably discharged, but couldn't make it happen. And so he just kept imagining himself back home, and he was in his home, and he wasn't wearing his uniform, and he was touching the sideboards. He was touching the door. He was sitting on his sofa. And after about 2 weeks of that, he got honorably discharged. Out of the blue for no real reason. And so it's that kind of thing. And so, sorry, this is a roundabout way of saying it, but I now would love to try going back to stand up, thinking myself, like as I step on stage, thinking I have just had a great gig. And then I get on stage, because it's all about like acting like you've already got whatever you want.
Yeah.
Because I think by the end, I was so braced for the worst.
That's so interesting. So you said you've done it. You used to do it when you did stand up at the beginning, but in terms of...
I sort of did it unconsciously.
Okay. Whereas now, this past year, you've been doing it very much purposely.
Doing it consciously. Yeah.
Okay.
Back then, I just think it was like the upbeat naivety of like of being young and like sort of having a sort of natural talent that took me a certain distance.
Right. Okay.
Before I had to like knuckle down and do some harder work on it.
Yeah. Okay. And you were saying you've been doing this with your friend. Has she also had positive experiences from it as well? And how do you do it together? What do you do? So you're just exchanging ideas of what you're visualizing?
That's it. Right. Or just going, oh, I've just had a thought that like, because there is a certain thing that like you have these affirmations where you say, I have X, I have Y, I am this. And just imagining yourself with things that you want. And bit by bit, it's like, well, why do you want like that massive success? And it's like, I want to feel talented and I want to feel appreciated. And it's like, well, can't you just feel that now? Do you need the trappings?
Right.
And so bit by bit, your affirmations become, I'm happy rather than I'm a millionaire. And so that's kind of an interesting process to work through. Cause it's like, yeah, if I look at all the things I wanted when I first started doing this at the beginning of the year, they've all boiled down now pretty much to like, everyone just wants to feel loved and accepted and cared for and seen. And so it's basically that.
Yeah, so it's more primal needs as opposed to, as you're saying, bigger picture type things. I want the big house. I want the money and all that sort of stuff.
I think the bigger picture is those primal things. I think the bigger picture is I want to feel safe.
Yeah.
And the smaller thinking is I want to own a house because then I'll feel safe.
Yeah, it's like,
well,
okay.
If you can make yourself feel safe now, then you can get that house. Sure, sure. Imagine that house, but you don't necessarily need it. And like, I find whenever I talk to friends about manifestation, they always begin with things like, I have got a development deal with Channel 4. And it's like, cool, cool, cool. And then bit by bit, those desires get bigger in terms of ambition.
Yeah.
But then eventually they all boil down to, I feel safe and I feel appreciated and I feel. And you're like, yeah, that's all anyone really wants.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
You know, you look for it where you look for it. Like, I've always looked for it in my career and other people look for it in relationships. And yeah, and no one's to blame and no way is wrong. It's just...
No, it's whatever's right for you, isn't it?
Right, right. And I think if you get joy and satisfaction from anything external to you, it's risky because that person could leave or they could die or, you know,
You
have to have that on yourself.
Well, in Buddhism, they talk about the philosophy of the state of impermanence. So nothing ever stays the same. Everything's always changing and evolving, no matter what it is you're doing, whether you're focusing on career, like you said, relying on a partner for your happiness. Eventually those things are always going to change.
Yeah.
So if you have a, if you can hold these things a little bit more lightness, then you're probably going to feel, or you're going to be slightly better about the situation when those things do change.
That's it. That's it. And I think definitely the idea of holding onto something lightly is hugely key because definitely I think before this year, I really felt like I was white knuckling a bit with my career, that I was like, oh, if I can just get that first feature made, then I'll be okay because then I can do this, then these features will get made. And then it's like, do you know what, man? That's all the middle. Like, don't bother yourself with the middle because it's none of my business.
Interesting. Like, it's always almost so you're like you're letting go, really, aren't you? Of that.
Completely. But not surrendering. Sorry, I can wang on about this for hours.
No, it's super interesting.
Whenever you want. But there's surrendering to lack when people are like, well, I'm just never going to make it. So I give up. I just give up. And that's surrendering to lack and that won't lead to anything good.
Yeah.
But then there's surrendering to abundance where you go, there is so much work out there. There are so many opportunities out there. There's so much money out there. I surrender. I'm going to stop chasing up the route that I think this is going to come from. I just, you know, let Jesus take the wheel.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not religious, but you know, that kind of idea. And then you busy yourself with other things, just do things that make you happy. And again, all of this sort of ignores the fact that you need money to live. However, I've always worried about money because I grew up without any. And this year, money has just always shown up in a way it never has before.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Which again, in a pandemic is just baffling.
Let me ask you, how do you marry that idea and philosophy with the nuts and bolts that comes with the industry side of things? So a lot of the time, you know, there's things that are decisions that are beyond our control. So you might be waiting to hear back on a production from a production company, a development exec, an agent, et cetera, et cetera. And as we know, like in this industry, it can be, everything takes fucking ages. Mm-hmm. How do you distance yourself from that and the frustrations that can come with that to this mindset that you're talking about, you know, of letting go?
It's none of my business. I've pitched on 4 things in the last week and a half. I'd love to win all of them, but it's none of my business.
Yeah.
Because I'd say 3 of them, I'm like, yeah, that job is mine. And I couldn't tell you how I know. I just know that job is mine. And the 4th one, I'm not sure. But either way, it's fine. Because I could win all 4 jobs and it will not change my life. It won't make me happier than I am right now. It might bring me more money, but money's not necessarily the key to happiness. Mm. So once I've pitched on something, I just try and put it completely out of my mind. Which is why I think I do so many things, because when people say, how do you find time to like write books along films? It's like, well, but I write my films, I send them out into the world. And then like, you know, your BBC studios or BFI are like, right, we'll read and get back to you. And it's like, cool, well, I'll write a book. So I'm now going to focus on writing my book and you come find me when you want to talk to me. But that's fine. But I'm not watching the clock and I'm not emailing you to say, hi, any news? Because, you know, if you're emailing someone, say, hi, any news? There's no news. they would have said.
Yeah, yeah. So you're master of your own domain, really.
Yes, yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that's such a healthy way of looking at things.
Which really sounds super smug, but like, my God, I've been doing this for 14, 13 years.
And you haven't always been this way. Yeah.
Okay. No, I started like this at the beginning because I'd always wanted whatever I'd got. Because I think, why was that? I think because I was very academically clever. And I think when you're young, if you're academically clever, the world is all pointing in your direction pretty much.
Okay.
So I was going to be an Olympic swimmer when I was younger. Right. And I didn't make it. And that was fine. I was just like, okay, I'll concentrate on my schoolwork. And I looked at some universities and I found one I liked. So I was like, I'll go here. So I got in. And years later, you look at how unusual it is to get into that university. It's quite oversubscribed. And I was like, wow, never knew. Never occurred to me. I started stand-up and I got gigs all around the place. I didn't realize how hard it was to get gigs because why would I know? I was just brand new. And I think maybe as well, that's why I so often start doing new things, because I like that feeling of ignorance when you just step into a new domain for the first time. You can't possibly be jaded because you just don't know anything.
Yeah.
Like you can learn about the craft. It's great to learn about the craft, but you don't know about the industry. You know, you don't roll your eyes when people say a script is in with a certain someone because you don't know that they take ages to read or they only have their favorites that they like. You don't know. You're just like shiny and hopeful and assume the best and good things usually come to you.
So what was the trigger that caused you to shuffle things around and take this different new approach at the beginning of the year?
It just wasn't working. That's what me and Yasmin were saying to each other. She'd been manifesting about 8 months before with her career, and I'd seen her career just take off. And she was like, now what you're doing isn't working. Like the jobs I was pitching on were just getting smaller and smaller, and still they were just sort of disappearing. They were just like something that looked like it was a completely done deal. The next day they'd go, oh, the funding's gone. We're not doing that anymore. And so she was like, just turn your back on all of it. And I was like, okay, I did. Yeah, fine, I did. And I just turned my back on all of it. For the first time ever, I didn't work 7 days a week. Don't think I worked.
Have you always done that traditionally, historically? Have you always worked 7 days a week?
About six. I write every day. Write down something. There's at least an hour I write every day.
Yeah.
It just doesn't occur to me not to. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then once I started doing that, I got an offer in on a job that was like a film for millions and millions and millions. Did I want to direct it? Pitched on it. I knew I'd got it, and I did. I won it. But we had genuinely just creative differences, and I had to walk off that one. But then another one came along, equally millions, when previously I'd been trying to get funding for like, you know, sub half a million projects and couldn't get them going. And then suddenly way bigger projects were coming to me. And everything just felt like it was running smoothly again. It felt like I was back in my stand-up.
Love that. Love that. That's great. That's
super. I have to really fight the urge to I feel like I'm sounding smug and I feel like I want to self-deprecate, but I don't want to talk shit about myself anymore. I spent so many years doing that.
You know what? It's funny you should say that. Like I've spoken to this, that issue with different comedians on the podcast, this thing where we feel you need to put yourself down. Because obviously it comes part and parcel of the humour, you know, the sort of self-deprecating humour that's so akin here in the UK. But you're no longer a comedian, so you don't have to do that anymore. It's fine.
I don't have to do it. I don't have to. And you know what? Even as a stand-up, I didn't have to. When I first started, I never self-deprecated and it never mattered at all. And then when I was starting to have a wobbly time of it, I'd have a couple of gigs where I felt that girls were being a bit bitchy about me. So I started dressing frumpier. And then a girl said to me, I can see you think you're dressing down and that just makes you look smug. And it's like, at that point, you're just second guessing people. Yeah. I mean, the trouble is people are drunk and you're sober. So like that, you know what I mean? They're always going to be so much more honest and blunt with you.
Yeah.
But and then the more you put yourself down, you only make insecure people like you. And who wants them? If I like myself. So if someone tells me they're doing well, I'm genuinely happy for them. Like I can hear that someone's got a job I went for, and genuinely, so long as I like them, I am happy for them, because, you know, like there'll be more work. It was always their job. It was never my job. We just had to pitch for it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like you can learn all the information you need on your area that you want to become, you know, an expert in or a professional, etc. But so much of it is about mindset. And if you haven't got that right, or even your just emotional state of being, if you haven't got all those things in place, either one, it's not going to work, or two, it will work, but you're going to be acting in a way where it's not going to be leading to a sense of well-being.
No,
you attach too much of your identity to that.
Yeah. There's this idea. God, sorry. I've become such a bloody hippie this year. But there's the idea of like your self-concept, which is your idea of yourself. And then there's your story. And you can have a really good story about yourself, which is I am really successful and people always want to work with me. But if your self-concept is that you're a victim and people screw you over, then you can bring all this work in, but it's going to go sour. Because you are going to be convinced that people are working behind your back and people aren't telling you things. And like, so, you know, you can be successful up to a certain point. But as you say, if your mindset is wrong, then you've maybe got one or two good films in you and then it's all going to go tits up.
Mm.
And I sometimes wonder that when I see like comics who were so promising when I stopped doing stand-up, and I see them kind of have some success and then I sort of see them disappear. Or not disappear, but like they just don't continue that trajectory. And I think I wonder if it's something like that you could bring the work towards you, but you just didn't have a kind enough and empathetic enough view of yourself, and you were too hard on yourself, and
there is a lot of that in comedy and just I think entertainment industry as a whole in terms of people being hard on themselves and like I've been guilty of it loads of times, you know,
of
just think like someone said, oh, you know, you're doing really well or whatever, and I was like, am I?
No, I'm not. Shit.
Yeah.
I still do that a bit when people say I look nice. I'm like, my jeans were 4 pounds.
Oh, right,
it's like, okay. Yeah, I mean, what do you want? Like, me and Yasmin always had this thing where we were the most amazing people in the world and the biggest pieces of shit in the world, and we can be both things at once.
Yeah.
And it's like, just bring both of them towards the middle, and like, you're enough. You're just good enough. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
No one ever teaches you that.
No, it's like it's human beings. Like it's so, everything's so nuanced. There's so many different elements to us. It's like, it's always changing as well.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember I used to listen to like interviews with really successful comedians or really successful filmmakers, and they always sounded so calm about their work.
Mm.
And I'd be like, you don't fucking deserve it then, because you're not excited by it. You're not like, wee. But of course they won't, because they were just like, this is appropriate. I work hard. I make good things, and I've worked my way up to this. So, you know, they don't act like they won the lottery, because it just feels really normal to them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's the mindset to be in.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. So sort of, they just take it in their stride, and that's part of it. That's part of that.
Because it's not the key to happiness. Like,
no.
It's nice to have nice things. You know, I've been rich and I've been poor, and I know which one is better, but, rich by my standards, but yeah.
Perfect. Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are, but I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like Balancing Acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat. So applying that philosophy, you're saying before about your career has always been your priority. And you said, you know, at the moment you're not in a relationship. Has that changed? Has that shifted now? Are you now thinking, oh, actually, that would be quite nice to have? Or is it more of a case of, with this new abundance mindset, your energy, you give off a certain energy, and then that will attract someone maybe who is of that same equilibrium at the right place in the right time, if that's supposed to happen? I understand that sounds ridiculously airy-fairy. Sorry.
No. It sounds so airy-fairy, and it's kind of word for word what I said to a friend the other day, because I don't, because I'm not on dating apps, because I just don't think I mean, I remember doing them 6 years ago, and like the third person I met was my partner, and we were together 6 years. So
okay.
The second guy I met, I got a really lucrative voiceover job off. So as far as I was concerned, I was like, Tinder is amazing. It's like LinkedIn and Guardian Soulmates all in one. but then this time around, I hopped on it again for a couple of weeks. And I was just like, it just doesn't chime with me anymore. It feels like nobody was unpleasant to me on it, but it just felt like everybody was giving like 30 people at a time a little bit of their attention. And it's like, we're all doing this. So it's just admin. But no, just to pull you up on something, not pull you up, that's rude, but like just something you said where I said my career has always been my priority. I think for me, my career has always been where I've put my self-esteem.
And yes, I've not
my self-esteem in my relationships. But actually, I think that's why I've always had healthy relationships, because I didn't ever look to them for people to validate me.
Right.
It's just I would get in a relationship if I met someone I really liked and just wanted to spend all my time with. And that was sort of always how I approached it. And that led to lovely relationships that, like, you know, we didn't end up married and together 40 years, but I don't think a relationship is a failure just because, you know, you don't end up with side by side headstones. But I do think this year I feel I've become so much more mature and happy and grounded in myself, but I've definitely become a lot more specific. I do think the thought of getting on a dating app and being like, listen, pal, I'm going to talk to you about manifesting, and you either get on board or you don't get on board.
Yeah, it's going to take a certain individual.
It is going to take a certain individual. But then I'm not trying to put together a football team. I really do just need one person. So yeah. I guess that's
You're done with the sketch groups, you know. No more ensembles.
Reforming another 8-9-person sketch group.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that's really interesting. And going back to the filmmaking side of things, I think one thing that writer and directors struggle with is partnering or finding a producer. How did you go about finding a producer? And is there sort of one, have you got one specific relationship, producer relationship, that person that you work with time and time again, or does it vary with each project?
I am quite prolific as a screenwriter. So I've got about 7 producers that I think are amazing and I always work with.
Great.
So I've got Nicole Carmen Davis, who she's just an incredible producer. And she was the first person to pay me to screenwrite in 2015. Okay. And so that film right now has a director on board, Shelley Love, and is moving into production next year, I hope. Then I've got mini productions, that's April Kelly and Sarah Huxley, and I've made shorts with them, and I've got a feature with them that we're trying to get funding for.
Okay.
And I work with QWERTY Films, who made Florence Foster Jenkins, and I work with Michael Kuhn, there is our exec, and Gavin Glendinning, and Jamie McDonald are my two producers there. So I'm really lucky. I have amazing producers I work with, and they're all different. But that's fine, because then I'm slightly different depending on how they're different.
Okay.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah. And how did those relationships come about?
I met April and Sarah at the pub. Michael, Gavin and Jamie approached me with a project they wanted me to write and direct.
Okay.
So that was quite easy. I produced a couple of shorts with my partner at the time. So we knew each other from living together. I'm not sure I've ever really met anyone through like a networking thing. I think finding my producers, they've often come to find me, and that's worked quite well. It's like, I think the agents, I've had loads of agents over the years, and the ones who've come to find me have always been the best because they knew they wanted me. So
that's a really good point. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Go on, sorry.
No, sorry. I was about to say, well, equally, there have been producers I've approached because I really wanted them. But I think so long as one of you really wants the other one, then that I feel that gives you a better chance of being a good partnership rather than being put together. But
On the agency side of things, when you have been represented by agents that you felt weren't necessarily the right fit, at what point did you arrive at the decision to like, actually, you know what, this isn't working, and you felt it was time to part ways? Because it's a really tricky thing to do, isn't it?
It's really tricky. And I think a lot of the time you're waiting for them to do one big fuck up and then you can go, right, that's it, I'm off. And I think that's what people do in relationships a lot of the time, that like they're unhappy, but they don't have the self-confidence to go, I'm just not happy, so I'm going.
So
it's hard. It's just hard. I mean, and to be honest, I've had some agents I've parted ways with. Like I was with Sophie Chapman at Troika, and I'd known her, God, because I knew her partner, Matt Green, through stand-up. So I'd known them over a decade. And I just was doing more and more film stuff. And she was repping me as a comedian and a performer. Mm-hmm. And she was the one to say, like, you should be doing so much better than you are. And I can't, she was like, I'm not in the right rooms for you. Go and get a different agent. And like, that was probably the nicest parting of the ways. But she was like, I have so much faith in you. So go and soar and spread your wings. And I was like, okay. Nice. It was really nice. Really nice.
Yeah, that's lovely.
But I think now with my new attitude, I do. Well, actually, that was another thing that Josie said to me when I first started, which was, again, I think she gave me two pieces of advice and I've stuck with them ever since. But one of them was, your agent is not your best friend. You have friends. You don't need them to be your friend. You need to have a good working relationship.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I'm very lucky right now. I have two agents who I love, and I love their company and I think they're really cool and I'm really fond of them. But equally, if they need to have a go at me for something, then they need to have a go at me for something, and vice versa. Mm. And it wouldn't be as if Yasmin gave me a bollocking. That would devastate me, and I'd probably cry. And with, you know, Hannah and Helly, I'd be like, well, that's just a professional thing I need to sort out.
Mm.
And I think that does take time. I think it really helps if you grow up in the industry. Like if someone goes into like show business and like they have parents who are in it, however tangentially, I just think there's so many lessons, you know, from the jump that we don't know. we don't know what sort of relationship you should have with a producer. We don't know how long a meeting should last or how you should conduct yourself, or that like you're not going into every general meeting looking to make a new friend.
Yeah.
Which I did for years.
Right. And how did that work out?
Poorly, really poorly. I mean, I made some friends, but like, you know, I was waitressing for years and years because I wasn't making any money.
Yeah. So were you doing, okay, so on that side of things, were you doing, you're juggling part-time work for a long period of time? And then if so, what was the point in your career where you were able to just focus full-time on all your creative endeavors?
Oh, I mean, I've still got my waitressing uniform in my wardrobe, but I'm not sure I'm ever going to bin it. Like, it's, you know, money's just money. It's like, it's not a sign of status. And, you know, there's people earning, oh, that's mean-minded of me. Well, no, look, there's people earning loads of money in the industry because they make shit. And there's a lot of shit that just gets made and is quite profitable. And that's cool. But, and if that's what you want, then do that. But I'd rather be waitressing and turn down jobs that I know are not going to, they're just not going to be things I can be proud of.
Yeah.
Because one day I'll be dead and all that's left behind is what I made. And nobody will be going, oh, she had a million in her bank account. Like, oh, well, whoop-de-doo. I'd rather you're watching my films and loving them. And so, yeah. I mean, the thing is, I would always have like good years and then lean years and good years and lean years. And so, I mean, I think I've done every job going, like for a while. I was a stand-up comedian. I was supporting Russell Kane on tour and we were playing big, big venues and it was really cool. But I was also a waitress dressed as a pirate sailing up and down the Thames. And whenever you tell people that, they're like, oh my God, that sounds so fun. And it's like, no, imagine that's really your job though. You're thinking about this because you have money and you own a flat. Think if you don't have any money and you're dressed as a pirate. There you go.
Pissing down with rain.
It's pissing down with rain. Your trousers are falling down. You don't know who wore these trousers before you. Your dad is the barman and having to help you pull your trousers up because you're holding a tray of canapes. True story. Very upsetting.
Yeah, the struggle is real. The struggle is real. So you mentioned before that you'd been part of the BAFTA, I think it's now BAFTA BFI network.
There's a thing called BAFTA Crew.
That's right. Yeah, that's really cool. Was that something you were recently a part of? And if so, how was that experience and was it beneficial?
I think I've been a member of it for 4 years. I think I've been a member
since
the nomination, actually.
Oh, right. I didn't realize that you could sort of continue as a member once you've been nominated. I don't know how it works.
Yeah, so it's not like being a BAFTA member. It's BAFTA crew is like, I think there's loads of us in it. You pay about 30 quid a year admin costs.
Yeah.
And you have to apply for it and you have to show you've been in the industry about 3 years.
Right.
And like, I mean, it's not life-changing, but it is great. Like, because there are things that like, you can do directors round tables where you sit with often quite a well-known director and there's 12 of you around a table.
Wow.
And they just tell you about their life and career. Yeah. And you ask some questions. And you go and see talks by, like, you know, went to go see Spike Lee give a talk to about 20 of us in a room.
Oh, fantastic.
And that was lovely. And like, again, and I won't name any names, but that is fascinating for going to see people who you think are the absolute top of their game, head of their profession. Mm. And once you're in a room with them and they're talking about their career, you realize they are so jealous of other people and
really
insecure, just not happy with themselves.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. There's no, if you're not happy with yourself, there's no magic point at which you're going to go, well, I've got 16.5 million in the bank now.
Yeah.
So now I'm happy with myself. It's like, you're just going to drag that shit around with you.
Yeah. And so it's so useful probably to be exposed to that earlier on in your career. So you'd be like, okay, mm-hmm. I like the idea of the career, but I kind of like to be happy with it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And
yeah.
Okay. And in terms of your writing approach, how do they differ from, I know you say you find writing books sort of comes very naturally and easily. How do they differ from writing scripts?
Books is hard.
Oh, books is hard.
Books
okay.
Is hard. Yeah. Books
is it, was it the other way around? Sorry.
God. Yeah. So screenplays, I find much easier.
Oh, that's
one easy.
Okay.
Yeah, because fine. I think of them as like a blueprint. I want them to be good to read and I want the prose to be elegant.
Yeah.
But I know that like a locations manager is going to get all over that and a production designer is going to get all over that. Art design is going to get all over that. Do you know what I mean? So a lot of the time I'm just outlining, it's sort of like a to-do list in some ways of what I need everyone to assemble to put in front of the camera, even if I'm not directing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what about in terms of projects where you've been commissioned to write a script and it's that process of doing redrafts and then you've got to send it over to the production company and that side of things? How do you find that process? And in terms of taking notes from execs?
Again, I'm very lucky. Like, I don't work with anyone who gives me notes and I'm like, ugh, that's such a shit note. Like, everyone who gives me notes, they're fantastic. Like, Michael Kuhn in particular, the newest person I've started working with, like, he is amazing for when I'm stuck on a script. We'll get on a phone call, and in 15 minutes, I'm like, right, well, yeah, that's the solution, isn't it? And he's like, yes, goodbye. He's gone, like, cool.
Fantastic.
But, yeah, like, definitely at the beginning, when I put all my self-esteem in my work, I hated notes. If people rejected my work, it was like mm-hmm. they were rejecting me. Like, I took it all very personally. And now I just, you know, even if someone says, I don't really like that script, I'm like, cool, that script's not for you. It doesn't mean I'm not a good writer. Mm. I'm still a good writer. And that script can still be good. It's just, it's not for you. And that's fine. So, yeah, I really don't mind it at all. And like, I really, and it's not like I don't get notes. I get noted like hell on my scripts, like line by line stuff, you know. But it always makes the script better. Oh, and sometimes I will get a load of notes. I will redraft it. And sometimes the producers I work with are honest enough to go, I'm sorry, I think I led you down the wrong path there. Actually, the way you had it before was better. Let's unpick and go back. Mm. And, you know, I don't mind because we're like, we all have the same goal.
Mm. Great. Yeah. Again, that's a refreshingly healthy, approach to take.
I'm a bit more prickly on my books.
Okay, yeah. So I was going to say, so to tell me about your process on the books. How does that work?
The books, it's just so much more work. And like the outlining part of it, like it just doesn't feel as collaborative. It is just you. And you have your editor. But I had an editor once who used to write not funny next to some jokes in the margins. And I was like, listen, sorry, you have to understand I'm a stand-up comedian to my bones. So when you write not funny, I'd rather you wrote something like your mother is a whore because not funny hurts me.
Fuck, man.
Deep level. But to her, I guess funny was like less important than plot, less important than character. So if she'd written like love that character arc at the top, for her that was a huge like complimentary note and not funny. She might as well have been saying, syntax or look at that comma or maybe a semicolon there. And I was like, no, that really hurts my feelings.
Yeah, I would not appreciate that whatsoever.
No, but I completely see that from her perspective. She had no intention of like riling me up or hurting my feelings.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, wow. So you in terms of your writing for books, you've jumped between a few different genres. Talk me through, how do you get into the mindset of writing for children? Because I know you got longlisted for the Waterstones Children Book of the Year for Girl Out of Water.
That was my first kids' ones.
Which is amazing, amazing for your first children's book. How do you how do you go about getting into that mindset to write things that you feel are going to connect with that age group?
I don't know. I think that does come to me quite naturally. Like I'm quite, I never think I'm very maternal, but then like 8 years old and up, I'm always quite good at talking to kids without much effort. And I don't know why. I think maybe, I couldn't even tell you. I think maybe I just can sort of, maybe it's like an improv thing. You just, if they want to talk to me about giraffes, I'm like, all right, we're all in. We can talk about giraffes. Yeah, I will talk about giraffes with you as long as you fucking want. But I mean, I just write a story that I think is a good story. And then an editor or my agent first, and then an editor will always go through it and be like, Jesus Christ, that joke is too adult. Oh my God, is that joke about what I think it's about? And I'm like, I'm so sorry. So like, the version that actually reaches bookshelves has been like gone through with a fine tooth comb because I don't feel like I'm like, hello boys and girls, here's a lovely story. Like it's, they always start off like more intense, more life or death, more grim, harrowing. And you know, I've never been very good at writing teen romance. It kind of turns my stomach. So that's why I wrote two teenage ones. And now I'm writing two that are aimed for 8 to 12 year olds. And I don't have to tell the romance. But I am now starting to write an adult one, which I think will have all the bells and whistles and sex and stuff in, but that's fine. It's just teenage sex squeaks me out.
Yeah, I can understand that. So when you got longlisted for that, and when I know you've also been nominated for a BAFTA for a short you've created, and also longlisted for a BAFTA for another project, do you have the same kind of mentality as you were saying you had with the reviews, as in you don't let them affect you, or are they sort of like affirmations, kind of like, yeah, I'm good at this, I'm on the right path?
I must be honest, like the BAFTA nomination was before I was like consciously manifesting, so I jumped on the bed with joy. And then when we didn't win, I think I did say fuck quite audibly in the ceremony.
It's understandable.
I don't think I took that too coolly in my stride. No, it's not. The funny thing is, though, is things with like the all awards seem to do this these days. Like they let you know you're longlisted, and you're like, cool. That's not really a thing, because you can be a nominee, but like you're never really a longlistee. That's not a thing. So then you wait 3 months to find out if you're on the shortlist, and then if you're on the shortlist, do you know what I mean? So like,
by
the time you win or don't win, you're like, you have been yanking on my emotions for a year now, and it's like the marionette with the strings that have just gone slack. I have no more emotions left to give you, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but I guess on the flip side, it's your credential, isn't it? You know, and you, especially earlier on in your career, it's like long list.
It's true. I think the BAFTA nomination has like, I think that has just been helpful so many, many, many times over.
Yeah,
like, and it will never not be helpful, and I will never ever not be grateful for it. But again, that was a funny one. So that was the first short I made. And I remember writing the script and I sent it to some producers I knew in comedy, because I just wanted them to tell me it was good. I think I needed the confidence. And two just never got back to me. And I think two of them actively said, I don't like it now. I think it's really like gross. And I was like, oh, okay. And my friend who was the director was like, fuck them, let's just make it. So I went and made it, brought it back, edited it, sent it to my agent at the time, who said, oh no, I can't send this to anyone, it's too rough. I'd be a bit embarrassed, but maybe make another one, see how you go. Didn't get into any film festivals. So for like 10 months, everyone was telling us we were sitting on a shitty short. Like, and people had said it was shitty from script stage. And then the second it was BAFTA nominated, it's like suddenly now apparently it's an amazing short. And it's like,
so funny, isn't it? How industry, how sort of like the industries perceptions changes dramatically when something like that happens.
Yeah, right, right. I think a big thing was people being like, the camera work is really wobbly, and then it became cinema verite very quickly.
Love that. That's great.
Like, it was made for 800 quid. So, you know, we were
fantastic.
Just running to get it done, and we were sleeping in the location, and you couldn't tilt the camera in certain directions because there were sleeping bags all over the floor, and you know.
Yeah, then those are kind of those experiences, I guess, are a real education and would tee you up to then go on to make features because you've done those kind of like.
I think that is an incredible thing with film, and you don't really get it, I don't think, in any other industry, is you get to make a short, which is essentially a mini feature. Mm. Like, in every intent and purposes, unless it's super low budget, you've made a mini feature. Mm. And I think with stand-up, doing 10 minutes does build you up to 20 minutes, but nothing builds you up to an hour. Because an hour, people really have to feel like they're in safe hands, but you can white-knuckle 20 minutes. I say, with good experience of white-knuckling 20 minutes and never feeling like I had them. But with an hour, people have to feel like they trust you.
Yeah.
But yeah, shorts to feature, it's such a privilege to be able to do that. And I think it's just not as normal to do that in America. So people just sort of leave film school and then they're like, feature time. And they spend 6 years working on one feature.
Yeah, which is a bit soul destroying. You just want to, I just want to make stuff. That's the thing. I get impatient when I'm writing things in development, long form scripts. I just want to be making something. I want to be on set.
Of course you do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if you didn't want to be making things, then that would probably tell you something that you're, that, you know, that that part of your career doesn't actually interest you that much, right?
100%. 100%. So what do you do outside of your career to relax and unwind? Have you got any hobbies, or do you exercise, any sports?
I swim a lot. I still swim. I went through a long phase of not swimming, but I swim now. I'd started cold water, at, like outdoor swimming in the lockdown.
Where do you do
So the docks by Canning Town.
Yeah.
But it does smell of sewage. So it really depends how cool you are with the smell of sewage. And the last time I swam there, something touched my leg and grossed me out. So I don't go there anymore. And Hampstead Heath Ponds, but there was a sewage pipe burst in the ladies' pond. So I'm a bit reluctant. So Parliament Hill Lido now for me.
Okay, nice.
I like that.
So you just feel fantastic after. It's just such an amazing
feeling, it's like drugs, isn't it? It's meant to see off dementia.
Apparently. I've heard that. Yeah, I do cold water showers every morning.
So, right, so you're just in your shower. You have a normal shower. And then you suddenly go cold, or you step into
I step into it cold. I usually, I try to usually exercise before. So at least I'm a bit hot, and then I go in. And do you know what? If I, you know, I sometimes wake up and I just don't feel in a good mood for whatever it is, or I might be feeling slightly down. That is just completely washed off me as soon as I have a cold shower.
Interesting.
And I might even be in there for only like a minute. I might be not, might be a minute. That's what I do. And at the same time, I'm, you know, saving water. So win-win.
Of course. Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I might do that because obviously all the pools are shut as well at the moment. And somehow lockdown two feels worse.
Here we are again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. It's like deja vu. Okay. So cold water swimming is a big thing for you. Yeah.
What do I do? God, it's really bad. Like, I love films. I watch a lot of films, much more than TV. Mm. I love to read. I listen to podcasts. God, this makes me sound boring. Do you know what I really love? And I really miss driving. I used to drive so much as a stand-up comedian. Mm. And then even when we were making short films, I would always drive the Luton vans with the camera kit in because I just really love driving a van. And I haven't had a car now in about 2 years, and I haven't driven in 2 years. And I think that is something I really missed. Maybe I get someone to rent me a sports car for a Christmas present, and I'll just go around a track.
Just drive around the North Circular.
Fantastic. Yeah. I want to drive really fast, though. Like, I've just done a gig in Wales, and I'm heading back in the middle of the night. That's where I got all my speeding tickets.
Okay, that's fun driving time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, proper mid-Wales. I can't stress that enough. Like, I literally won't see anyone on the road for an hour. I'm not just recklessly bombing through Penarth.
Okay, so a couple more questions, because I feel I've taken a lot of your time, but it's been really interesting.
This has been great. Yeah.
Great. favorite films? And with that question, I'm going to ask you which directors out there are kind of like the ones you either aspire to, or you kind of like, this is the career that I am going for, or that I would ideally like.
Jurassic Park, favorite film.
Classic.
Always. Mm. I think I just saw it at a certain age where I was like, oh my God, magic is real.
It is fantastic. Wow, that was, what a feeling. Yeah.
It was incredible. Do you know, I can never give a decent answer to favorite film because
I know I feel like it's actually a bit unfair to me, because I hate that feeling when you're being put on the spot. It's like you scramble around, you panic, and as you've got all these.
Well, also, I've done a load of interviews recently, and I've been asked this every time, and I was like, I'll just sit down and think of my favorite film, and then 10 minutes pass, and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna make some toast. I don't know. I've got a huge list, and then I go, yeah, but how often do I actually watch that? And like, yeah, I watch Schindler's List. I watch Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. Loads, because it just makes me feel really safe and warm.
Oh, that's
but
nice.
It's, you know, but anyway, in terms of directors, like, I could think, obviously, like someone like Spielberg just has a way of like tapping into magic, like just pure magic that like no one else can. And I think he also can just like, I think so much of directing is just being in charge of the tone, deciding your tone, knowing what it is, being able to tell everyone what the tone is, and like shepherding it through the whole long film process right into post-production, and then be like, that was it. That was the tone I was going for. Because sometimes it's so nebulous, you can't even put it in words. It's just like, you know, that feeling when you hear that beginning bit of music, it's like, that's what this film feels like. Mm. So yeah, Spielberg for that. Fincher, I think, for like just how very, like I find his really dark films make me feel very safe. Like I watch Zodiac probably once a month, and I don't know why, it just makes me feel like I'm in such safe hands. And I think it's because of how meticulous his camera work is and how fantastic the storytelling is, and the script is amazing, and all those reasons. So great. I think it's Spielberg and Fincher. Can't choose two men. But then also there's like, there's women I love, like Greta Gerwig, Mariella Heller. Mm. But it is kind of who you grow up watching as well. It's like your idea of famous people. Like I will never go like funny over meeting someone who got famous in the noughties onwards, because right. I was an adult then. So, yeah. You know, but if I met Michael J. Fox, I would absolutely disgrace myself.
Of course. Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay, great.
I'm gonna ask you, art, isn't it?
It is 100%. It's like there's like a feeling of nostalgia that comes with that, because you know that was that period when you're growing up, and you know you're informed by art at that time, and it has such an impact on you in a different way when you're younger.
Yeah, it's, you know, the heart is so open, and
exactly that. Yeah.
Also, and like, sorry.
No, go on.
No, we've got a slight delay, but I'm also really bad for talking over people. That is such a stand-up green room thing. So you go.
God, I can remember what I was going to say now. As you touched on before, just you're at an age where you can buy in and believe in the magic. And I think part of that comes with, you're not at a point in your life where you're jaded by experiences. And so you can fully buy into that Spielberg magic and let that take you away to another universe.
Well, I think that's what this year has done for me. I think that I had got quite jaded with life in general last year, and everything felt very uphill. And then when Yasmin started telling me about manifestation, and she kept saying, I know, she's Irish, she's very down to earth in many ways, but she was like, I know it sounds ridiculous. And I just thought, well, why not open your mind back up again? Why not open your mind up to like the way it was open when you were, I mean, God, I couldn't even say 14, because I think even by 14, I knew to like scoff and roll my eyes at things. But like 11, when I was 11 and the world was just open and I was open-hearted and sincere about everything, and I hadn't been laughed at enough at that point. Mm. So I was like, why not just open your mind back up and say, I know that sounds silly, but I don't mind sounding silly and I don't mind you laughing at me. Like, I'd rather that than be jaded and cynical and eye-rolling and like, oh, it's all right for some, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, very British way of being.
Yeah. Do you know, on my last short film I made, the horror film, I was with my two producers and we were scouting in a field and like we were hauling huge bits of iron around the field to like set dress it, like properly big bits of a vehicle. And this guy stopped and sort of remembered one of the producers from when she was younger. And firstly did the, you've grown, and looked at her boobs, which we were like, oh God, man. But he was a bit younger than us. And he said, what are you doing? And we said, oh, we're making a short film. And he said, oh, it's all right for some, isn't it? And he's just like, the fuck do you think? Like we're literally dragging bits of iron around a field. And does it look like for a second we're earning good money dragging these bits of iron around a field? But just the idea of like, it's all right for some, it's like, yeah. That it's somehow like a spoiled, pampered, indulgent thing to do, to shoot a short film.
Yeah, I mean, with that attitude is like I mean, I have no idea what that person does, but that element of sort of bitterness with not necessarily of following their own like passions and dreams and seeing other people doing it is a reminder of that.
Yeah, maybe. Like that is something actually that like I thought even last year when I was really struggling and I felt very, very far away from achieving my dreams. And I still thought, well, at least you know what they are. And some people don't have dreams, or the dreams they have, they don't feel like the socially acceptable ones, because it's not like, I don't know, to be a famous singer. It's to have a family and feel loved and significant within your family and safe. And like, that is a perfectly acceptable, like, proper dream to have.
Yeah.
But I think some people feel embarrassed if that is their dream, when people are like, I want to be a published author. And like, yeah, I think sometimes just even acknowledging what you really want in life is really hard and feels embarrassing. And as soon as you've said it, it's like you think the world can then go, well, you're not going to have it now. Fuck you for wanting something.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of like faith and trust to say, I want this and I'm going to get it.
Would you be okay to share what yours is? I know we talked about it being you sort of like die, you sort of dig in and it becomes more about the overall like happiness, but in terms of talking about career stuff and that's where your career is going in projection, is there like an ideal dream for it?
There's no one ideal dream. I'm really lucky, particularly this year, I am now living my dream career. Like, I would like a love life and I'd like to own my own home. And maybe I'd like a family, but maybe just a dog. I don't know. Yeah. I sort of would need a partner to have opinions on that. And then I could go, okay, cool. Right, I agree or I disagree. But basically, it's like all the films I'm developing this year, I want to be making them and I want them to be out and I want them to be a success. And all the books I'm writing this year, I want them to be out. And do you know what I mean? So like, it's really, my dreams are everything I'm on the path towards, but I just want this path to keep going and to earn a bit more money.
Yeah. I get that.
Which sounds very boring, but then I just think this year I made huge leaps ahead with aligning myself with what I actually wanted and then getting what I wanted. And so my dreams now feel like, where once they felt like there, they now just feel like they're just here.
That's great. What and a lovely feeling.
They're just there. Yeah, it really is. I feel very lucky.
That's great. Okay,
well, I'm going to ask you, Yasmin.
Yes, yeah. We'll do a dedication to Yasmin at the top of the episode.
Please do.
So two more questions I'm going to ask you before we wrap things up. First is, are there any books that you've read over the years that have had a massive impact or inspired you in some way?
Yes, yeah. I always love Stephen King's On Writing. I'm sure everybody who listens to this podcast.
I only finished that this year. I finished that in lockdown one.
Lockdown one. Were we air so young? It's great, isn't it?
Really good. Really good.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's just so refreshing to read something by a writer who doesn't like hide behind talent and be like, I don't know, I just sit and do it. It just pours out of me. Mm-hmm. And Stephen King is like, I don't even know if I'm that good at writing, to be honest. So here is how I make myself be the best writer I can be.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so humble and warm and kind. Like, it's the most compassionate book. And I love it for that. It feels like a hug.
Yeah.
So I read that. There are a lot of screenwriting books that like I've dipped in and out of, but I'm not sure if they've changed much about how I work. in the blink of an eye, the book on editing, mm-hmm. I found that was a large part of my at-home film school. I read that a lot.
Okay.
Part of my whole like journey of woo and manifestation, The Divine Matrix by Greg Braden is a book that I've reread a few times this year. That it's just the idea that we are all connected and you are a hologram and you're existing at every stage in your life at any given point.
Okay.
So you have achieved all your dreams right now. You're also dead at the same time.
Yeah.
And you're also a baby. And, you know, I mean, again, it's easy to scoff at and it's like really big out there ideas, but I found it so inspiring and it really made me start thinking along different lines and started me writing a book that I don't think I ever would have written if I hadn't read that.
Brilliant. Okay, fantastic.
I could keep going, sorry, but I'll just take ages.
That's great. Thank you. The final question I'm going to ask you that I ask all the guests on the podcast is, what does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
You've picked a good year to ask me this. I think it's calmness. I think it's contentment. I think my life right now feels really quite balanced. Like, you know, lack of physical contact aside and pandemic and not being able to see my friends physically. But I don't think there's anything you could take off me that would make my world collapse. And I think that is balance. I mean, obviously there's some things like my health. That's pretty huge. So yeah, if you took that off me, I'd be really quite fucked. But I think especially in terms of my career, if you took a part of my career off me, I would cope because I don't like put all my self-esteem in one place anymore. I think it's that. I think it is just that feeling of calmness.
That's a great answer.
Same question to you, please.
It has been evolving, I think, particularly over the last year, because that was the reason why I started this podcast, because I felt that I lacked balance and I was very curious as to how other creatives were finding that or not. And very similarly, actually, to what you're saying, it has definitely been a shift for a long period of time. It was always about striving for the next thing career-wise, and I still have an element of that. And you know, perhaps that's ambition, but I'm sure that's also...
What's ambition and what's dissatisfaction?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. There's also deep-rooted into like whatever you could classify as childhood trauma and feeling the need to prove yourself or prove myself. But that is also, you know, intertwined with the passion I have for what I'm doing. But that aside, Very similar to you, this idea of trying to let go and have a bit of a distance from it and it not being the be all and end all to my sense of well-being. And so things like, you know, I meditate every day. When I meditate every day, I exercise every day, I speak
Everyone
to people.
Says I should meditate because I have terrible tinnitus. And I know
really?
I should. But when I'm meditating, the tinnitus is just unignorable.
That's hard.
So
yeah, that's tough. Yeah. Imagine that's really tough. What about if you did a audio meditation? So if you're listening to a guided one.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I might try that. Thick Nut Tamp. Oh, I've definitely got that name wrong.
Headspace is one that people really like. That's an app. You can download that. And they've got loads of guided meditations. I don't know if that would make a difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely worth a try. Listen, in lockdown 2, we're all made of time. I might as well try it.
But
do you know what's interesting as well is several times I've said in like talks or whatever that like the idea of like getting some distance from your work and like it not being the be all and end all. And then there's always someone who pulls me up and is like, but that's a lack of passion. And it's like, well, I think it's professionalism because I think you could look at a lot of very talented filmmakers and invariably the one dud in their canon is the one they really, really, really cared about. The project they pushed for like over a decade to get made. Mm. Like, do you know what I mean? I do think sometimes you have to remember that like what you're doing is a job and you want to do your job as well as you can.
Yeah.
And all the passion and love and like, but I dreamed of this when I was a child. Like, who cares if I'm watching a bloated 4-hour film that you were too close to edit better? Do you know what I mean? And I think that is definitely something that I've learned, that, like, you know, it's like going into an audition saying, I really, really, really need it. No one wants to hear that actor.
And the thing is that that neediness, you can smell that a mile away. And so,
you
know, I think it's imperative if you, you know, to be able to have that distance and not place, as you were saying, you know, your whole identity and importance in the success of whatever that project is. And also, you know, by having other passions, by having other pastimes and taking time out, that's where a lot of the inspiration comes from.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I used to beat myself up a bit that film was like my second career, and I would tell myself I was too old. Like, this was back when I was just being mean to myself 24 hours a day. But actually, I think there's a lot of people who knew they wanted to make films. So they went to film school at a very young age, left film school, started making films. And it's like, at what point did you live a life that gave you any experience to make a film about something worth watching?
Yeah.
Like, where's your film about being a pirate on the Thames? And like, and actually, that said, those people are always the ones that if I tell them about a thing that happened to just happened to have happened in my life, like, no matter how harrowing, if I say that, like, you know, I had a really bad problem with anorexia for about 10 years, you should make a film about that. And it's like, I suspect you are so bereft of events and like themes in your life to make a film about that if something crops up, you're like, that's it, grist to the mill, throw it in.
Yeah.
And like, I think you can get like that with stand-up as well. Whereas when you take a big step back and you really think more holistically, you get inspiration from, like, it's not just shit that happened to you. It could be a conversation you had with a friend that a year later you find you're still thinking about.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I think that ties in with that, you know, there's that old adage, write about what you know. So actually, that's pretty limiting, you know.
It's very limiting, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. And like, maybe you want to discover more about like what you know. Like, I have many different conflicting views and feelings about motherhood. I really don't know where I come down it one day to the other. And the horror film I've got with QWERTY, it's about motherhood, and it's about motherhood from a different angle than anybody would expect. And it was through writing that film and talking about it with my development team that I really like unlocked a few things in myself that I never realized I felt about motherhood, that I was like, wow, I think it would have taken me years to realize that about myself. But here we go.
So you, it's almost like, you know, you're finding out things about yourself. It's almost like a version of therapy through your own art and creative endeavors.
Definitely. And I think it's like it means it's sort of a journey of discovery for me as I'm writing it, which doesn't mean that I'm discovering the story as I'm writing, because I really do believe in plotting and outlining, but it does mean that like certain themes come up that like deepen the characters and deepen the journey that they're on when I realized how much that's resonating with me. And it was just something I never really looked at in myself before.
Interesting. Yeah, that's great. Where can people find out more about what you're up to on the old social medias or website or whatever is your preference?
I'm on Twitter far too much, but listen, our only social life these days is a nice walk, so I'm on Twitter a lot. I'm Nat Lertzimer on Twitter. I mean, I don't Google myself, but I have been told if you just Google Nat L-U-U, it's only me. There's really no one else with that name, so if anybody wanted to find me, that's how you find me.
Okay, where does that name derive from?
My dad's Dutch, half Indonesian, half Dutch.
Got you. Okay. All right, well, look, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks so much for your time. Yeah, it's been really enjoyable. Perfect. And there we have it, Nat Lertzimer in the building via Zoom. Hope you've come away inspired to manifest your dreams. I've been manifesting that off the back of that conversation. You guys have just thought, wow, I really need to leave a very positive review of this episode on Apple Podcast, and that's what you've done, because I manifested it. So that's fantastic. But in all seriousness, fantastic conversation. Really enjoyed chatting to Nat. And next week we have got Andrew Gold on the podcast. Andrew is a documentary maker. He's a Louis Theroux in the making. He's had documentaries on BBC Three, HBO. And we talk about his whole journey to becoming a documentary maker and host, as it were. So that's a really good conversation to look forward to in the next episode. So until then, see you later.
Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.